Joining us now on Books and Arts, we have three guests who are united in their appreciation of David and of his work. Ivor Indyk is the founding editor and the publisher at Girimondo Publishing. Hi, Ivor. Welcome to the program.
Very much.
Dr. Yvonne Smith is a Sydney writer and independent scholar who's writing a book about David Malouf's work. Yvonne, welcome to the show.
Welcome. Thank you.
And Jaya Savage is a poet. He's also the poetry editor at The Australian. Jaya, welcome aboard.
Thanks, Michael.
On this very, very happy day. So, Yvonne, you wrote your doctoral thesis on David's work and now you're writing a book. When did you first encounter him?
Look, I think it went back to around the early 1980s, and probably Fly Away Peter, I think, was the first book of David's I read. And really from that time on, I was always reading his books. I guess I was drawn to them when they came out. And I also was teaching in secondary school for quite a few years. So the students always had the pleasure of reading books via Malouf as part of my course. But when I was starting my doctorate, I was very, very interested in the whole creative process of how his writing had come about. So I looked particularly at the manuscripts in the Fryer Library at the University of Queensland just to see how he had crafted his work.
Let's discover what you discovered there a bit later on in our conversation. Mm. But Fly Away Peter, what was it about that book? It came out, what year was Fly Away Peter? 1982.
That was 1982.
Yeah. What was it?
I think initially it was the way he linked the migration habits of the birds with the really horrible process of war, to bring those two things together and to have them talk to each other, I thought was really interesting. And I really like the characters that are in it too. The bird watcher, Jim Sadler, Imogene Harcourt, who was a photographer. They seemed in some ways like ordinary Australians in some ways, and he was able to take people who were part of the ordinary life of Australia and take us inside their mind, inside their eyes, and take us through an experience which had been so transforming for the country.
Jaya Savage, what about you? When did you first meet David Malouf?
Well, I first met David in the early 2000s at an Irish bar in Brisbane. He was giving a reading there, and at the time I'd recently quit a law degree and was making my way through, doing some groundwork to study literature and studying Latin, and that had taken me to read his second novel, I believe it is, An Imaginary Life. So I walked up to him there before his reading, actually, and told him how transformative that book had been for me, as a fellow Queenslander at the time.
You told him you'd thrown away your career as a lawyer, your lucrative career as a lawyer.
Well, I might not have told him that in as many words, but I told him what the book meant to me.
Tell us about An Imaginary Life, Jay. What's that about?
Oh, well, it's about the Roman poet Ovid having been exiled by Augustus in the golden age of the Roman Empire. It's about his time out on the outskirts of the Black Sea, at the very edges of the Roman Empire, and rediscovering language. Well, the fact that nobody speaks Latin out there on the Black Sea, these are barbarians, and it was remarkable to me that he was a Brisbane writer, a writer also of Moreton Bay, where I grew up, who was getting inside the mind of a great Roman poet,
and writing with that very broad horizon.
Yes, something that was very foreign for me at the time. But he was generous enough to say, first of all, he said, "Do you read Ovid in Latin?" And I said, "Well, I'm trying." And yes, and he said, I'll tell you what, I'll send you a translation that he by a friend of his." And sure enough, several months later in the post, this translation arrived, actually with a few drafts of some poems of his, especially some poems that would show up in typewriter music later. So I was thrilled, and that was the start of a great friendship, really.
Oh yes, well, that's a very intimate start, isn't it, to a friendship? So how old were you?
I would have been 22, I think. Yeah, 22, 23.
And he was what?
Oh,
if he's 80 now, how long? What have you been?
David's kind of ageless to me. He's a spry soul. It's a soul. It's filled with wonder. The way you can see that in the poems, and even in the latest poetry collection. I couldn't tell you actually how old he was at the time.
Yeah, when you look at him face to face, he is extraordinarily fit and well-looking man. So, Ivor, what about you? When did you first meet David Malouf?
I think it was in the late 1970s. I was a lecturer at the University of Geneva and specialising in Australian literature there, believe it or not. And it was between Jono and An Imaginary Life. And I remember giving a paper on Jono to a conference in Besançon in France. I remember a lovely afternoon on the beach at Grosseto, which was near where David was living in Campagnatico. So I give you both a critical moment and a personal one.
Let's talk a little bit about Jono. It's his first novel, came out in 1975, and it's set in the world of David's childhood. We've just heard him talking about that world. Let's just hear a grab from it.
Like most sons, I suppose, I'd forced upon my father the character that fitted most easily with my image of myself. To have had to admit to any complexity in him would have compromised my own. I chose the facts about him that I needed. His one solid gold tooth that glowed when he laughed, like a miraculous image in a southern monastery. His talent for walking on his hands along the beach at Scarborough, strutting about like some exotic bird, carrying his body through the air as if it were plumage, heavy, extraordinary. I found these images of him comfortingly foreign.
Shane Porteous there, reading from David Malouf's first novel, Jono. Gosh, he could really do it, couldn't he? Right back in that first novel, he really... He was really writing extraordinarily well. So what was the impact of that novel? Did it mark him out as somebody special, or was it just a novel in the great mix either?
Well, it was really important as a novel of place. It brought Brisbane alive in a way which, you know, few writers had been able to bring their own cities alive. And David subsequently went on to make large claims for Brisbane, which I think were totally justified in terms of it being really at the centre of the world in the 1940s because of the war effort and the basing of American troops there. Also, he saw in Brisbane a kind of Athenian ideal reflected in its colonial architecture, a kind of Mediterranean climate and certain kind of openness. I think for myself, the most important thing about Jono was really the way it explored masculinity, Australian masculine ideals, because the narrator, Dante, is caught between two different ideals of masculinity, the self-made man. It's important to recognise that David's own father was of Arabic background, Lebanese Catholic. So the whole ideology of the self-made man was very, very strong. But, of course, it's in Australian culture from the beginning. Henry Handel Richardson's The Fortunes of Richard Marnie is about the self-made man, but from an Anglo-Irish perspective. And on the other side, an alternative which was very attractive in the late 1960s and early 1970s, the revolutionary young man, you know, the man who wants to blow up the world, and that's Jono. And what's really fascinating there is the way that Dante carves out a place for him between these two ideals. And I think that persona, Dante, you know, then gets filled out more and more fully in the course of David's writing. It becomes a whole sensibility, a defining sensibility, really.
Yvonne, do you want to come in on this?
Yes, what I found most interesting about looking at the origins of the book was that it took David so long to write that book. He'd actually started work on it in the early 1960s in England when he was teaching there, and had written a couple of different versions of it. And it was only in around 1972 when he was in Florence on a sabbatical break from his lecturing at Sydney University that he felt he finally found the voice to start the book. And he said that he had to set aside a lot of cleverness, a lot of things that he might have thought were clever about being a writer, and actually write in a voice that was more like his poetry, more like a poem like The Year of the Foxes. And that gave him a tone which he felt was going to take the book forward. So it took him about 10 years to get that first novel to the state where he felt he could publish it. And yet he'd been, you know, writing stories since he was a little boy, in fact, but he was over 40 when he published that first novel.
It's a kind of paradoxical mixture of decorum and vulnerability, I reckon, that makes it all work. Now, Yvonne, you've been rummaging around in his imagination in a way that seems a little bit improper to me, but you've been looking through his typewritten notes and his drafts and so on that are held at the University of Queensland's Fryer Library. So there you are, getting to know him, perhaps in a way he doesn't know himself. What have you been discovering?
Well, I must say I've only discovered things because David's been generous enough to point me in the direction of certain areas. But in the manuscripts, what I found very interesting in Imaginary Life particularly was that first scene that he wrote in around October 1976, where he describes Ovid suddenly coming across a scarlet poppy as he's walking along the shore there at Thomas, that this was such an important piece of imagination for David that in fact empowered him to write the whole book. And looking at through the manuscripts, I was able to locate what I thought was the actual first typescript that is still available. And on that he'd handwritten some of the key phrases, like, you know, poppy, poppy, you have saved me, and things like that. It enabled me to see how he started the work and then how he had developed and introduced more drama, introduced more of the dynamic of Ovid's imagination, actually changing from a sort of a cynical metropolitan poet to being someone who was really engaged with this place that he had first thought was completely desolate and a place where he'd just die in exile. And looking into that, I wrote to David, and he kindly, I think I had met him once at that stage, he sent me quite a detailed letter and extracts from a diary he kept at the time he was writing Imaginary Life, in which he mentioned to me that Judith Rodriguez, his friend, an Australian poet, when she first read Imaginary Life, she said that she thought it was very autobiographical, in fact, more so than Jono. And that has very rarely been taken up in any critical writing about the book. And I find that most interesting because he said that he felt it was a record of his inner life, an imaginary life. And yet it's been discussed so often in post-colonial terms, in Freudian or Lacanian psychology, but very rarely really looked at as the next book after Jono, and one that pointed to something about his imagination that had happened that had really transformed him and made him perhaps into the writer that he was becoming.
Yes, that's a fascinating idea, because Imaginary Life looks as though it's a complete turning away from that world of Brisbane into something sort of grand and classical. Now, we're talking about David Miliff. It's his 80th birthday today, and this is Books and Arts Daily on RN. And in the studio, in our Sydney studios, are Ivor Indyk, Yvonne Smith and Jaya Savage, all here to celebrate the work of David Miliff and have a chat about him. Now, Jaya, you're a poet, and while this prose writer is coming to light with Jono and Imaginary Life, they were 75 and 78, they came out, the poet was already a published artist. Can we talk about that?
Yes, I believe there were two volumes were published prior to Jono. Oh, correct me if I'm wrong there. David is a remarkable poet. He wears his formidable lyrical skills very lightly. A lot of his poetry is brimming with virtuosic music, really, far beyond rhyme. And, I mean, that's evident in the last collection before this one, Typewriter Music, in the title poem of that, where you can't imagine a greater evocation of the sounds of a typewriter in language than that poem. Also, as a prose stylist, I think that feeds back into the poetry to some extent. Just where most poets would probably end a line and end a sentence, David will have two extra clauses which will run over extra lines, and his skill at following a thought through beyond where a poet would normally sort of cease that thought, I think is something that's very, that's something that I notice anyway.
You mean in his prose? You mean there's something poetic about his prose?
No, perhaps controversially I'm suggesting the opposite, that his skill as a prose writer with the sentence and the syntax, juggling the many clauses, say, of a multi-barreled sentence, that is sustained in a remarkable way in the poems. That's such something that I've noticed over the last two collections. And the other thing that I think is there in the poetry that I alluded to earlier is this sense of wonder that all writers have, even good philosophers have it. But there's a poem, Ladybird, I think it is, in the recent collection, you know, where the second half of that poem is mind-blowing. Just this childlike sense of wonder, but with a fully formed, mature imagination and ability to express that sense of wonder. That's one of the strongest impressions that the poetry leaves. Makes on me anyway.
Can I ask you, Ivor and Yvonne, what do you make of this? This idea that you can see the prose writer in the poet, and I guess the poet in the prose writer. Do you see the two sides of him influencing each other?
Yes. I find it impossible to say which way it goes. I think, for me, it goes from the poetry to the prose, that he is fundamentally a poet, and that his prose, both in his perspectives, his use of imagery, the way he constructs his novels, essentially like poems, really. But more than anything else, in terms of his rhythm, for me there's just a distinctive Maloufian rhythm. And it's lyrical, obviously. It's accumulative. It's David insists in both his poetry and his prose that all things are equal, that the most ordinary things contain as much significance as the largest things. So there are no hierarchies in his work. Therefore, the rhythm is one of accumulation, of curiosity, and also of attentiveness. Jaya refers to this capacity for wonder in his writing. He's always attentive and curious. And it's interesting, I think, that this attentiveness, which we associate with a lyrical, poetic sort of stance, is also that of the essayist, because the curiosity, you know, leads him to expand ideas, to look, you know, behind things, to see their causes and in front of them for their consequences. So I can't really distinguish very clearly the priorities in David's capacities as an essayist, a poet, a novelist, or indeed a librettist for that matter.
Mm. Yeah, I think for me too, the way that the ideas and the images flow between his poetry and his prose is one of the delightful things, I think, about his work, that as you read his poetry, it does remind you of episodes in the novels. And sometimes you can find him working over an image in a poem that is later expanded and taken further in a work of prose. But I think, as Jay is saying, it feeds back and forth. And certainly he, from around the 1980s, he was certainly publishing a lot more prose than poetry. Typewriter Music was the first new collection that had actually emerged since First Things Last, around 1981. So it is interesting that he did have a long period where he certainly was still writing poems, but not choosing so much to publish them. So perhaps his prose took over a lot of his imagination after he really felt those first three novels had been written and that he had work before him as a writer. But it's lovely to see that interconnection. I think of a poem like A Poet Among Others, which is about the last years of Osip Mandelstam in exile in far reaches of Siberia. And that really led into a lot of imaginary life for David. And you can find those interconnections, I think, a lot. I think that's one of the lovely things about his work.
On RN, this is Books and Arts Daily. I'm Michael Cathcart, and we're celebrating the 80th birthday of the Australian author David Maloof. With me are publisher Ivor Indyk, Yvonne Smith, who is a Sydney writer and scholar who's an expert on Maloof's work, and Jaya Savage, who's a poet, in fact, poetry editor at The Australian. Let's talk about this idea of the exile. This is a question I didn't ask Maloof in that interview we played earlier on, but Maloof, like Jono, did manage to escape Australia, and he spent a fair portion of his life writing full-time in Tuscany. Maloof did, I mean. Here he is commenting on this in 1981, because the exile, he says, is a label he's always resisted.
No, I don't think of myself as being... I mean, I always think of myself anyway, wherever I am, as being... as having sort of partly a social life and partly as living kind of in my own head. And in my own head, I'm always in the same place, wherever that is. And the rest of the time, one's more or less isolated. I quite like being very isolated and being alone.
That's David Malouf in 1981. So this paradox of a man who's written so much about Australia and Australian identity and yet who's lived so much of his life overseas, what do we make of that?
Well, we all came, you know, from somewhere else or have been displaced, you know, from our places. So that's not a wonder. That's not a strange thing in itself. But I think David's right. I don't think he thinks of himself as an exile, but certainly that land inside himself, which is the land of the imagination, it has its own contours, and he's right to insist on it as being separate. And I think it's only natural that those who devote themselves to the land of the imagination would also feel a certain kind of loneliness or isolation. Those two things go together. You know, you'd feel the separation between the land of the imagination and the land of the real world. So I think the point about exile in relation to an imaginary life is really that is the land of wonder, where of it is, with all its dangers and its threats to personal relationships. And you really have to place that in the balance, because on the other side there is the land of relationships and intimacy and social sense of community. And the two go together. Just because there is an insistence on the imagination doesn't mean that the imagination can't also be put at the surface of a larger, more social kind of ideal. And I think that's, to a large extent, David's achievement is to have made the imagination one of the central qualities of Australian identity.
Yes, I'd agree with that. I think the way he insists that Australians have an inner life, whether people want to admit it or not, I think I find that very endearing. It's almost like Chekhov, actually, the way Chekhov insisted that Russians had an inner life, you know, when he was writing. That I think that idea of exile is more the sense of being, as I was saying, perhaps separated in some way by an intense imagination, by an intense way of looking at the world, which can separate you from people. And even when he was living in Italy, you know, this is not often recognised, he did come back to Australia quite regularly. Mm-hmm. And he had a lot of visitors in his home in Campagnatico. And so he really wasn't out of touch. He was writing articles that were published in Australia on Australian writers. So his time in Italy was not always, it wasn't years and years away from Australia.
Mm. Yeah, I suppose we have different paradigms. We have the expat from Australia, and I think somewhere in one of Clive James' memoirs he talks about, you know, those who went back, and he wonders, you know, he sometimes thinks that it was better of those who went back did greater service and so on. But as far as the exile's concerned, you know, he's certainly not in that model of, say, James Joyce, the classic sort of 20th century self-exiled from Ireland, but yet still in his imaginative space speaking to Ireland and about Ireland all the way through. And I think that partly, you know, the roots of this, the migratory experience and so on within Australia anyway, preclude that classical modernist sense of the exiled writer. Mm, mm. It's more complex than that already for the Australian writer. So I certainly agree with David and with my fellow panellists on that.
On Books and Arts, this is Books and Arts. I'm Michael Cathcart, and we're celebrating the 80th birthday of David Malouf. Now, a subject we haven't discussed is sexuality, and James has tweeted, he wonders if Jono, in the novel Jono, Malouf imagined Brisbane as a place for the self-made gay man. We were talking about it as a place for the self-made man. James writes, I thought that was one of the more interesting aspects of the book, The Emerging Sexuality. And Daniel's tweeted that he encountered Malouf when he was in year 10, when Daniel was in year 10. Malouf had a poem in a collection which Daniel thinks might have been called Stars. He's not quite sure. But it was about two men in love. And Daniel says, it set me alight. How much is sexuality part of Malouf's identity as an Australian writer?
Well, it's certainly part of his conception of Brisbane. I think that point is absolutely right. There's something about David's sense of Brisbane as its climate and its openness, as being particularly as a place where sensuality can be freely expressed. You know, Patrick White had a rationalisation for his homosexuality, which was an aesthetic rationalisation, which was that it allowed him to inhabit both masculinity and femininity. It didn't confine him to a particular gender position. And I think that that kind of approach is similar to David's as well, aesthetically speaking.
Yes, I always find he's... I think he's tried to avoid categories, and perhaps he thinks in his writing of people, certainly, you know, their sexuality and their gender, all those things are there, but he tries to avoid difference being something that would be entirely separating to characters. His idea is to integrate and to bring together often, and to question the basis of difference rather than to create it. So I would think he tries to appeal very broadly to an audience.
Add that, you know, while talking in aesthetic terms about the universality, if you like, of the homosexual perspective, that wouldn't detract for a moment from the intense eroticism of his poetry, those poems that are erotic, of course, and particularly of An Imaginary Life, which has some of the most extraordinarily erotic moments in it. And it's interesting in David's work the way in which personal eroticism, you know, is bound up with a sense of communion with nature. You know, there's the famous poem about the crab, where the eating of the crab...
Yes, the crab feast.
Crab feast, you know, which is the most extraordinary...
remarkably
erotic poem, but it's also about communion with nature. So I don't think you can separate those two either.
Well, panel, our time has whizzed by. It's gone so quickly, hasn't it? Just as we wind up in 30 seconds, for the reader or the listener who's not read Maloof before, perhaps you could... suggest where to start, perhaps with your own favourites. Ivor, what's your favourite? Where should we start?
My favourite book?
Yeah.
I think Imaginary Life is really the one that is most compelling about the imagination and its range.
Yeah, and what about you, Yvonne?
I'd start with Fly Away, Peter. I just think that book connects very well with it, with readers.
All right.
And I can't go past either of those, and I agree absolutely with both of those, but I would say the new poetry collection, Earth Hour, you know, by about page 10 or 11, I just arrived on a plane yesterday morning from Paris, and it feels like the plane is taking off. The poem Whistling in the Dark is an instant great Australian poem, and from there it just soars, this book. So, yeah, I'd say Earth Hour, go and get it.
Well, it's been a wonderful conversation. Thanks to all three of you for coming in and celebrating this very happy day.
Thank you.
Ivor Indyk is the founder of Giramondo Publishing. Dr. Yvonne Smith is a Sydney writer and independent scholar who's writing a book about David Maloof's work. And J.S. Savage is a poet. He's also the poetry editor of The Australian. Well, let's end with the man himself, David Maloof, reading what he's described as perhaps his only attempt to tackle a subject as large as love. This was recorded by the ABC in 1970. It's David Maloof reading Easier.
Easier, I mean, than to speak of what we share beyond all this, night journeys hand in hand across distances like Russia, homecoming at dawn, pale sunstalks in our hair.
David Maloof reading his poem Easier. And a big happy birthday to David, who turns 80 today. And a big thank you to the guests there on our panel for celebrating with us. And thank you to you, too, for being here to celebrate it all. So the two books that are most recently out from David Maloof are Earth Hour, that's published by University of Queensland Press. That's the collection of his new poems, a collection of his new poems, and A First Place, which is a collection of essays going right back over a couple of decades, two or three decades. That one's published by Random House.